into Australia by boat is automatically placed in those detention centres and either sent back to their country of origin or resettled in third countries. They will not be allowed into Australia. It's a very controversial policy. The government of Tony Abbott has insisted that it's the only practical approach to stopping the boats. They say that this is for the safety of those of the asylum seekers themselves, because they argue that in fact by stopping the movement of refugees, they're effectively shutting down the people smugglers, who are responsible for so many deaths at sea. Whether or not that's actually saving lives is a debatable question. Whether this is the best way of doing that is something that is a debate that I think is still ongoing. And one of the key elements to that debate is whether it's appropriate to keep those asylum seekers on those islands in those detention centres in conditions that, frankly, we know are quite severe, but we really haven't been able to examine properly because the press simply isn't allowed access.
Finally, you laid a wreath along with Shirley Shackleton, the widow of Greg Shackleton.
Yes.
A story I think our viewers and listeners know well about East Timor. He was killed in the lead-up to the Indonesia's invasion of East Timor by Indonesian forces. Yes. You laid a wreath at the graves of war or monument to war correspondents who have died.
That's right. This was something, and I'm getting goosebumps actually with remembering this. This is something I'm very proud of. The Australian government has, after a long, long time, and the Australian War Memorial has agreed to a memorial to not just the correspondents who've been killed in action, to war correspondents who've been killed in action, but to all those who serve in conflict zones as reporters. And I think it's an extremely timely reminder of the role that foreign correspondents, war correspondents play in keeping people informed of what's going on. We have to have a place that's accepted. The government accepts that we have a legitimate role to play. And it's right and proper, I think, that role is memorialized.
I want to thank you so much, Peter Gresta, Al Jazeera journalist. You can go to our website to read the transcript. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is John Schuck, host of Religion for Life, and this week is the third of my three-part series on clergy who have left the ministry, and in some cases, left God. My guest this week is former Seventh-day Adventist minister Ryan Bell, who took a year off from God and then blogged about it, A Year Without God. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
He was born a pauper to a pawn on a Christmas day when the New York Times said God is dead.
KBOO Community Radio is seeking an individual or group to contract with to help build our next 3-year strategic plan. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shares knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. We've been serving the Portland community since 1968 and are one of the oldest independent community radio stations in the country. The person or group who is selected will co-lead the development of a strategic plan with the KBOO Strategic Planning Support Work Group, made up of volunteers, board members, and staff. More details about the application process can be found at kboo.fm/planrfp2015.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Shell Oil has decided to stop drilling for oil in the Arctic.
Portland Police Chief Larry O'Day has apologized for the backlog of sexual assault evidence kits and vows to start testing the kits.
And a new report shows that oil companies are leasing public lands for extremely low prices while making excessive profits from those lands.
Mm-hmm. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 28, 2015. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Rosalyn Scott. The Shell Oil Company announced today that they are calling off exploratory oil drilling in the Arctic Ocean for the foreseeable future. After receiving final approval this summer from the Obama administration to drill in the Arctic, Shell drilled an exploratory well, but they say that they found insufficient quantities of oil and gas to continue with operations and capped the well. The Shell Oil exploratory well was drilled almost 7,000 feet into the bedrock in the 150-foot deep waters of the Chukchi Sea off the coast of Alaska. Shell reportedly spent about $7 billion on their Arctic drilling operations, battling harsh weather conditions, fierce protests from environmentalists, and strict regulatory requirements. We'll have more on this story in tonight's news in-depth feature at 5:45.
Environmental Minister Mark Doran released a single planning policy statement today that will prohibit the controversial shale gas extraction method on the grounds that its climate impact is still not fully known. The SPPS, Single Planning Policy Statement, which provides guidelines to Northern Ireland regional councils on about 20 different policy areas, from infrastructure and planning to community development, implements a town center first approach to retail and business development. Royson Wilmot at Northern Ireland's Royal Town Planning Institute said that this is good news for their members in Northern Ireland and that the much-anticipated SPPS will be a catalyst for positive change on the ground. Publishing the SPPS unlocks development potential and supports job creation, but not at the cost of the planet, environment, and people. Significantly, for the first time, no to fracking is actually enshrined as a policy unless there is sufficient and robust evidence of its safety on all environmental impacts. Doran believes that this is a sensible and reasonable approach.
Over the past week, Portland hosted the first ever Emerging Green Conference. For 3 days, major players in the global electronics industry met to discuss issues important to sustainable and green technologies. One of the keynote speakers was from Hewlett-Packard, one of the U.S. government's top 25 defense contractors. HP also has a contract with the Israeli military to install and maintain a biometric ID system in Israeli checkpoints in the occupied West Bank. These checkpoints deprive Palestinians of freedom of movement in their own land and allow the Israeli military occupation to grant or deny special privileges to the civilians under its control. Neither of these issues were addressed in the conference, which focused mainly on ways that companies can mitigate the impacts of climate change on their bottom line. Jonas Allen is the director of marketing for the nonprofit Green Electronics Council, which organized the conference.
Oftentimes, green and electronics are only really considered in like the recycling conversation. About where do I take my phone? Where do I take my computer? Is my school fundraiser, you know, recycling e-waste? But there's a lot more that goes into making that electronic recyclable. And for those parts that maybe aren't recyclable or can't be recovered, you know, how can we reduce the environmental impact of those? So in that sense, the conference has been a wonderful success because we've had so many people here who are interested in sustainability and chemistry and engineering and design, getting them all on the same page, getting them in the same room to have a conversation about how do we do that. It's been great.
The Electronics Take Back Coalition works to promote life cycle producer responsibility, the idea that the creators of high-tech electronics should assume responsibility for where such goods are disposed. Co-founder Ted Smith stressed the impact of toxic components in many consumer electronics. These materials affect the health of the workers in these industries and are often disposed in various countries in Asia and Africa.
The Electronics Take Back Coalition was formed about 10 years ago to try to address this through policy and public education. And since that time, we've developed a kind of a model state plan for encouraging the proper disposal and the take back of electronic products. And there's now state laws in about half the states, including Oregon. Oregon is one of the early adopters of this. But there's still a huge amount of material that is being exported, and it's still an enormous problem. I was involved in a report that was done in 2002 called Exporting Harm, and it documented the shipment of e-waste from the U.S. to China, and it actually had video showing how the materials are being burned, literally, to burn the plastic to get to the metals. Excuse me. And unfortunately, that is still going on. So that's a big part of our work.
Of North America, a provider of green certifications for businesses and products around the globe. Bach says these third-party standards are essential, especially in the absence of government action.
There's two ways of going about it. One, meeting the minimum requirements, so everybody's on the same playing field. There's also, hey, if you do this and you put this logo on your product, you will stand above your competition if you go the extra mile. We can certify that. You can prove it through the certification to others, and therefore you have access to a larger market.
Rob Holloway is the director of Giraffe, a consultancy that works with major companies to ensure their product designs are environmentally sound. Holloway says not including toxic materials to begin with eliminates the problem of disposal altogether. This is one aspect that he calls the circular economy.
Is really a design flaw in many respects, because you know we're dealing with waste at end of life, and it needs to be factored in at the beginning of the design process. So designers need to be smarter, frankly. They need to think about the end of life issues, but they need to do it with sound environmental science and also a understanding of the local infrastructure in place to use and recycle these materials at end of life. And of course, the priority should be reuse and extending life before you go to recycling, and obviously ultimately ends up in landfill or energy from waste. So it's about getting the environmental constraints in at the early stages of the design process so that you design out some of these waste problems at the end of life.
Those were the voices of participants in the Emerging Green Conference held this past week in Portland.
Medical marijuana dispensaries are gearing up for this Thursday, when many of them will be able to legally sell marijuana to adults with government-issued IDs. Measure 91, passed last November in Oregon, allows possession and also allows growing plants for personal use. That began on July 1st. The state of Oregon will not be ready for regulated sales until after January 4th of 2016. So, in a temporary stopgap measure to curb black market sales, the state will allow dispensaries to conduct sales tax-free. There are at least 10 cities and 2 counties in Oregon that are prohibiting early sales. More than 200 of Oregon's 345 medical marijuana dispensaries have notified the Oregon Health Authority of their intent to sell, although some of the dispensaries have not completed the application process yet. Washington State, Colorado, and Alaska have also legalized adult-use retail marijuana sales, although Alaska is still working on how they will regulate the market. Compassionate Oregon, a nonprofit group that advocates for patients, says they are worried that the prices for medical marijuana will rise if recreational demand outgrows supply. They've sent letters to dispensaries asking them to maintain at least a portion of their product for medical marijuana patients and to also serve patients before recreational users inside the stores. Some of the adult-use retail merchants have signed the pledge, while others have not. Sales of marijuana in Portland and other cities will begin on Thursday, in spite of a lack of preparedness by state agencies.
The current Portland Police Chief, Larry O'Day, has apologized for the massive backlog of untested evidence from sexual assault cases in the city of Portland. The Portland Police Department has a stockpile of thousands of untested sexual assault evidence kits dating back to 2002. Now that the city has received $3 million in grants and funding meant to address the national backlog of untested evidence from rapes and sexual assaults, the chief of police says the city will start to carry out the needed testing for the Portland cases. Mayor Charlie Hale says that the lack of testing in the past is unacceptable. Meanwhile, Hundreds of survivors of sexual assault in the region have had to deal with the fact that the police have not followed up in a comprehensive way on the crime that was committed against them.
The houseless rest area called the Right to Dream 2 has been waiting for nearly 2 years for a new site to be approved by the city of Portland. In April, politicians had found R2-D2 a new home, opposed to the one they have currently in Chinatown, and that move could have happened by the end of summer. Now, however, a camp organizer doesn't think that the move will happen until 2016. This means that the rest area will spend a fourth winter camped at the base of Chinatown Gate, despite more than 2 years of efforts to find a new home. Commissioner Amanda Fritz said that she hopes that R2-D2 can move before winter sets in. Mayor Charlie Hales, who last week said that he would declare an emergency to find shelter for all homeless women by the end of this year, also said he hopes the Right to Dream 2 rest area can move by the end of the year. But Ibrahim Mubarak, Right to Dream 2's co-founder, doesn't expect the camp to move before 2016. He says that the city moves quickly to address problems for the business owners, but not for the homeless. The city of Portland signed a purchase agreement with R2-D2's landlord, Michael Wright, which includes a stipulation that the camp will be gone by October 2016. City officials have made some progress toward that end, but many steps remain. The city bought an east side property at Southeast 3rd Avenue and Harrison Street from the Oregon Department of Transportation at above market value. This was paid for by the money it received in a deal to prevent Right to Dream 2 from moving to a parking lot in the Pearl District. The city also paid for an environmental and air quality analysis of the property, which is surrounded by industrial businesses. The air quality is better than the Chinatown site, and no pollutants or contaminants were found that would pose immediate health concerns for potential residents who stayed less than a year. That raised some concerns in Hales' office because Right to Dream 2's residents aren't necessarily healthy, which is all the more reason for Portland to be moving people inside. Portland will probably pave the site following a recommendation from a separate assessment to cap any chemicals in the earth. The city still needs to finish zoning plans that would allow the camp with small modular buildings. Commissioner Amanda Fritz previously said that the city would need to hold a hearing on the move. As of today, however, no hearing appears on the council's long-range calendar.
Classes are back in session today in Kelso, Washington, after teachers ended their 8-day strike. The teachers came to an agreement with the school district this weekend after making numerous concessions from their original demands. Classes resumed today after the teachers voted last night to approve the agreement. The main complaints by the teachers were about their low pay, overcrowded classrooms, and excessive workloads.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Daphne Wysham with the Center for Sustainable Economy about Shell's decision to stop drilling for oil in the Arctic. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's show features a new group, Time Does Not Fit the Crime, which has brought new energy to the fight to reform Measure 11, Oregon's mandatory minimum sentencing law. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather, sunny, with a high near 82, south-southeast winds at 3 to 7 miles per hour. Today in history, in 1941, Ted Williams of the Boston Red Sox became the last baseball player to bat 400. The soul singer Ben E. King, whose hits included Spanish Harlem and Stand By Me, was born in 1938. And in 1991, legendary jazz trumpeter, composer, and band leader Miles Davis passed away. The quote of the day is from Miles Davis. "Jazz is the big brother of revolution. Revolution follows it around."
It's 5:18. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
We've got a new darling in the GOP presidential race, Carly Fiorina. Being the darling du jour, however, can be dicey. Just ask Rick Perry and Scott Walker, two former darlings who are now out of the race, having turned into ugly ducklings by saying stupid things. But Fiorina is smart, sharp-witted, and successful. We know this because she and her PR agents constantly tell us so. Be careful about believing anything she says, though, for darling Fiorina is not only a relentless self-promoter, but also a remorseless liar. Take her widely hailed performance in the second debate among Republican wannabes, where she touched many viewers with her impassioned and vivid attack on Planned Parenthood. With barely contained outrage, Fiorina described a video that, she said, shows the Woman's Health Organization in a depraved act of peddling body parts of an aborted fetus. "Watch a fully formed fetus on the table, its heart beating, its legs kicking," said a stone-faced Fiorina, looking straight into the camera, while someone says, "We have to keep it alive to harvest its brain." Oh, the horror, the monstrosity of Planned Parenthood! And how moving it was to see and feel the fury of this lady candidate for president. Only, none of it is true. While she urged the audience to go watch it, there is no such video, no fetus with kicking legs and beating heart, and no demonic Planned Parenthood official luridly preparing to harvest a brain. This is Jim Hightower saying, so, did Fiorina make up this lie herself? Or did her PR team concoct it as a bit of showbiz drama to burnish her right-wing credentials and advance her political ambition? Or maybe she's just spreading a malicious lie she was told by some haters of Planned Parenthood. Either way, there's nothing darling about it, much less presidential.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The American Federation of Teachers, union-owned Amalgamated Bank, and the National League of Cities Sunday announced a $100 million commitment to renovate classrooms for early childhood development. The announcement came at the 2015 Clinton Global Initiative meeting. The supporting groups will create a $100 million construction loan fund to renovate 350 existing classroom facilities in seven cities. An additional 250 new classroom facilities will be built in three cities. In the next 3 years, 36,000 children in early childhood education programs will be helped. AFT President Randy Weingarten says she's proud her union is helping to address the pressing need to invest in America's infrastructure. Keith Mestrick, president and CEO of Amalgamated Bank, says for nearly 100 years, the union-owned bank has worked to uplift the middle class. He says investing in education is the first and best step to real high-quality jobs and stronger communities. Alabama workers at Commercial Vehicle Group are looking forward to negotiating their first union contract after their vote to join the United Auto Workers. High health care costs, pay issues, and the company's use of temporary workers led to the union victory. The plant, 85 miles northeast of Birmingham, produces seats for commercial trucks. Seattle's minimum wage law has been upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. A business group sued to try to overturn the law, but the court handed Seattle workers a victory, upholding the Seattle $15 an hour minimum wage. This win for the fight for 15 comes on the heels of a Washington State Supreme Court ruling that all SeaTac airport workers should get the $15 wage approved by city voters there. And now with WIN's news analysis from Paris, here's executive producer Frank Imspach.
The news from Europe is Volkswagen. One in seven German jobs depend on the automobile sector. About 80% of VW sales in Europe are diesel. It is clear that there is no way that millions of cars could be equipped with a software system that is designed to operate the engine one way when being tested and another on the road. To design, build, and install such a system requires a corporate commitment. But the story does not end with VW. It is likely that all car companies understand the technology required. Does that mean that other companies may be doing the same thing? Meanwhile, thousands of jobs are now at stake, as is the health of the German economy. The scandal also raises questions about the German system of co-determination. Unions are present on the administrative committee of VW. What were they doing to oversee the situation? Will they see their role as insisting that the company evolve into a greener, more sustainable firm? This is Frank Emsbach, executive producer of Workers Independent News.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
If you like this labor news we're presenting, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation today released its new Uniform Crime Report for the year 2014. The Bureau reports that there were more than 1.1 million violent crimes reported in the United States last year, for a violent crime rate of about 365 reported violent crimes per 100,000 population. That's roughly the same as the rate for 2013. There were more than 8.2 million property crimes reported in 2014, for a rate of nearly 2,600 offenses per 100,000 population. That's a 5% lower rate than we saw in 2013. There were more than 1.56 million arrests for drug violations in 2014, just over 1.5 million property crime arrests, and nearly 500,000 arrests for violent crimes. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Eric Sterling, executive director of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, to put those numbers in context.
As a general matter, the total numbers of arrests don't tell you as much as you want to know compared to the ability of the police to clear the crimes that have been reported to them by arrests. So, for example, in the crime of rape, only 38.5% of the reported rapes resulted in an arrest in 2014. For robbery, for example, only 29.6% of the reported robberies resulted in an arrest. There are many more property crimes that take place. There were reported to be on the order of 1.5 million burglaries, for example, compared to 83,000 rapes. Of those burglaries, however, only 13.6% of them resulted in an arrest. Or in the case of motor vehicle theft, there were 640,000 reported motor vehicle thefts in 2014, but there were arrests in only 12.8% of those cases. So public safety is not simply violent crime, which has gone down dramatically across the country. But it's a sense of security. You're concerned about whether or not your car is going to be out front. You're concerned about coming home and will your house have been broken into. And those kinds of crimes are much more frequent than violent crimes. And I think that people consider that an important part of public safety.
Now, staying with clearance rates for a moment, this year is the first time in almost two decades that we've actually cleared 20% of reported property crimes. It's not a great track record, but there has been a little bit of improvement over the past few years. Are people who commit property crimes getting easier to catch, or are we doing something different?
Well, the development of increased surveillance capacity gives store owners and police a much greater ability to identify suspects and therefore make arrests. So that to the extent that property crime includes a crime like shoplifting or crimes that can otherwise be detected, you have home-based security systems now hooked up to the internet with webcams. So in many respects, it's much easier than it was some time ago to detect crimes as soon as they're happening and to identify the perpetrators. And so that's one reason that property crime clearance rates have improved. I would argue, though, that these are still very low rates, given the enormous effort that the law enforcement agencies still are spending on making drug arrests around the country, and especially marijuana arrests.
Well, in fact, more than 80% of all drug arrests were for simple drug possession. What does the number of drug arrests and possession arrests say about our law enforcement priorities?
Law enforcement priorities are driven department by department by what chiefs of police want and what they think the public may want. Drug arrests are easy to make, especially possession arrests, because drug use among young people is fairly widespread, and people are often not careful to avoid signaling that they might be a drug suspect. If you have clothing styles, band insignia on your vehicle, police can make many stops and find people and make drug arrests relatively easily. The police departments have great incentives to do this in two respects. First, the federal government awards special drug enforcement grants based on police department arrests. The federal government does not give grants to police departments to stop rapists. The government does not give grants to stop murderers or child abusers. So that drug arrests bring federal grant money to the police department. The other piece of it is because these arrests are very easy to do, they don't involve complex investigations, they can result in arrests which bring a police officer into court, which means that the police officer is eligible for overtime pay. Here in Montgomery County, Maryland, where our offices are located, we're the largest jurisdiction in the state of Maryland. Our police union contract provides a minimum of 3 hours of overtime pay automatically for every officer for every time they are subpoenaed to appear in court. So if you're part of a team of officers that make a roadside marijuana bust, your name is on the arrest report and you're going to be subpoenaed and you're going to be in court every time that case is called. So this is known as collars for dollars and ends up being a very powerful distorting factor in how criminal justice resources are deployed.
Terrific. Well, Eric, thank you so much. I've been speaking again with Eric Sterling, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. They're on the web at cjpf.org. Eric, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Doug.
This is Doug McVeigh for KBOO News.
Advisory was issued today due to high levels of blue-green algae in the Clackamas Cove portion of the Clackamas River, located at Clackamette Park in Oregon City. Water monitoring has confirmed the presence of blue-green algae that can produce toxins. Health officials have urged people to avoid contact with the blue-green algae as it could cause skin rashes in some people. These toxins cannot be removed by boiling, filtering, or treating the water with camping-style filters. Exposure to toxins can produce symptoms of numbness, tingling, and dizziness that can lead to difficulty breathing. The public will be advised when the concern no longer exists. This is a similar algae bloom that took place in the Willamette River in the Ross Island Cove just over a month ago.
The bargain basement deals that gas and oil industry titans enjoy for leasing drilling rights are estimated to have cost the U.S. taxpayer billions over time, according to a new report from the Rainforest Action Network. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with one of the report's authors, Ruth Breach, about the study that names the top 15 companies who lease these lands, the Filthy 15.
I'm talking with Ruth Breach. She is the Climate and Energy Campaign Specialist with the Rainforest Action Network and one of the authors of a freshly released study called Public Lands, Private Profits. Can you tell me what inspired this report and how long ago the work began?
I started at RAND in late April, and what we were seeing with the climate movement was a need to kind of really address the urgency of this crisis that we are all in now. And several minds came together in the spring and created this coalition of national groups that is focusing an effort on President Obama to end fossil fuel leasing on public land. So I entered the conversation there, and one of the questions that we had amongst our team here is, who are the companies that are actually operating on federal land? And there just wasn't a lot of information about it. So what we aimed to do was release a report that really detailed and named names of the companies that are operating coal mines, that are doing offshore oil and gas drilling, and they're doing onshore oil and gas drilling and fracking. So we felt like that was a point of intervention, of really understanding who's who on this list, and then to approach them directly and challenge them to stop the leasing and stop the drilling and mining on federal lands.
Of what you learned in the research, what would you say were the biggest surprises?
There were a couple. This was actually a really interesting project. Some things to consider that we saw here is that you're seeing names like ExxonMobil, Shell, Peabody Energy. These are major players. But actually, what I thought was really surprising was the Mormon Church holds leases for the Deer Creek Mine in Utah. So even the Mormon Church is in on the deal.
If I'm understanding this report correctly, in some instances, the resources on the land are being leased for $2 an acre?
Yep. In some cases, that is the minimum bid. And even 2014 and into 2015, we're still leasing federal land for as little as $2 an acre.
And in the real world, what would the value of this use for the land be?
The Government Accountability Office actually did a great report on this a couple years back, showing that the Bureau of Land Management, one of the trustee agencies that's responsible for administering the lands, because these are actually our lands, they're the public lands for the public, the public pays for them, and then the agencies take care of the lands. And what we saw there with this Government Accountability Office report is that the fair market value was assessed differently in every field office. So there's several offices around the country. And the only thing that was consistent was that they consistently provided the lands below fair market value. So we're just seeing a lot of inconsistencies within the agencies. The Bureau of Land Management, Department of Interior is kind of the overall agency that houses all the smaller ones, and it's just like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
Today's report comes exactly 2 weeks after a letter to the president signed by 400 organizations as participants of Keep It in the Ground. Was the White House aware that the study that we're talking about today was in works at the time?
Yes, we've been working on this research probably since about May. So all summer, we met in Washington, D.C. I was a part of that coalition that delivered the letter to Obama. And we met with Obama's administration. It's the Council on Environmental Quality. This is more of like a policy group that advises the president on what's kind of politically feasible.
What's the track record of these companies in terms of their environmental stewardship, these filthy 15?
What we found is that the corporate culture is really destructive. We dubbed these companies the filthy 15. So these are the top leaseholders on public lands and coal, offshore oil and gas, and then onshore oil and gas. The track record is not good. You've got environmental destruction. So think about BP and the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. Exxon is also on this list. Still years ago in the Prince William Sound. We've got companies that have not paid their royalties and fees that they're supposed to pay for mining and drilling on these lands. We've got people that are operating in indigenous sacred sites. So they're sites that have been formally designated as sacred, and companies are trying to drill in those areas.
There's been that two-week window since the letter from 400 organizations in today's report. How would you characterize the dialogue in between those two events?
I think a lot of this is that I like to call it a marination period, where the powers that be kind of need to soak up what's happening. Today's announcement with Shell is pretty awesome. Shell is pulling out of Arctic drilling. They're citing because of cost. There was huge public opposition and outcry on this issue. So I think this is a huge victory for everybody that floated in a kayak on the West Coast.
I've been talking with Ruth Breach from the Rainforest Action Network. For more information, you can visit the website at ran.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
A leading conservation group warned that overfishing, destruction of marine habitats, and climate change have been pushing marine life to the brink of collapse, which has led to a loss of almost half of the world's marine mammals, reptiles, birds, and fish within a single generation. The Worldwide Fund for Nature, or WWF, on Wednesday released an emergency edition of its Living Blue Planet report to highlight this dangerous trend ahead of the United Nations Sustainable Development Summit later this month. At the meeting, world leaders are expected to formally approve the UN's Sustainable Development Goals, and WWF is warning that without profound changes to the way the ocean is managed and protected, the world may be facing an ecosystem collapse. The Living Blue Planet report has found to date, around 1 in 4 species of sharks, rays, and skates are now threatened with extinction due primarily to overfishing. Tropical reefs have lost more than half their reef-building coral over the last 30 years. Marine vertebrate populations declined 49% between 1970 and 2012. If current rates of temperature rise continue, the ocean will become too warm for coral reefs by 2050. The study also highlights the impending social and economic crisis, as fish and other marine life are critical for the food security for billions of people, a large sector of which live in developing countries. The collapse of ocean ecosystems could trigger serious economic decline and undermine our fight to eradicate poverty and malnutrition. Researchers found that populations of fish species most utilized by humans have fallen by at least half, with the critical family consisting of tunas, mackerels, and bonitos decreased by 74%.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has announced the discovery of a record cold area of water in the northern Atlantic Ocean. Scientists believe the unusually cold water is due to increased glacier melting in Greenland and Iceland. So much cold water from the melting glaciers is entering the Atlantic Ocean that it is slowing the current of warm water flowing north from the Caribbean, called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. This northerly flow of warm water heats the Atlantic Ocean, resulting in milder winter temperatures for both the Northeast United States and Britain. The increased cold water flowing from Greenland and Iceland has caused the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation to slow and stop hundreds of miles south of where warm currents usually end. It is believed that the cooler temperature of the northern Atlantic Ocean will cause harsher and wetter winters for the Northeast United States and Britain.
NASA announced today that they recently discovered flowing water on Mars. Dark streaks running down the slopes of a mountainside on the surface of Mars appeared during the Mars summer, but disappeared during the Mars winter. Closer inspection by the NASA Reconnaissance Orbiter found the chemical signature of water molecules. The NASA scientists believe the liquid water is not an actual stream and that the water is highly briny and filled with toxic perchlorates. Scientists believe Mars used to have liquid water the size of the Atlantic Ocean, but more than 85% of the water has evaporated into space.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, September 28, 2015. Palestinian fighter die in Gaza and soldiers invade Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and attack residents inside. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of the Hamas movement, has reported that one of its fighters was killed on Monday while working in one of its border tunnels. in a press release, the Al-Qassam said that Majid Sakani from Shuja'iya neighborhood east of Gaza City died while working in the tunnel. Dozens of Palestinians not affiliated with Hamas or other armed resistance groups have been killed and injured in tunnel accidents while working to provide food for their families in the impoverished and besieged coastal region. In other news, dozens of Israeli soldiers, police officers and undercover forces invaded on Monday morning Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem, fired gas bombs and concussion grenades, causing many injuries, before forcibly removing the worshippers and surrounded dozens others in Al-Qubli Mosque. Eyewitnesses said that around 150 soldiers and officers invaded the holy site and started forcing the Palestinians out by firing gas bombs, concussion grenades, rubber-coated metal bullets, and several live rounds. The soldiers also assaulted many Palestinians with clubs and batons. The invasion also led to clashes between the invading troops and Palestinians in the mosque and its courtyards. The Israeli attack caused fires at the main entrance of Al-Qubli Mosque, but local firefighters working in the Islamic Waqf department managed to contain it before it spread. Many residents were injured and received treatment by Palestinian medics in the mosque clinic. In addition, soldiers stationed at the gates leading to Al-Aqsa prevented dozens of worshippers from entering the mosque courtyards, especially through Bab Hatta and the chain gate. The soldiers then assaulted many Palestinians and started pushing them away. The removal of the worshippers was carried out while dozens of Israeli fanatics gathered nearby and marched into the mosque courtyards under heavy army and police accompaniment. On Monday at dawn, Israeli soldiers have kidnapped four Palestinian children in Atur village in occupied East Jerusalem. The Wadi Hilwa Information Center in Silwan in Jerusalem said that the soldiers invaded and ransacked homes of the four children before taking them away. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, September 28, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Rosalind Scott, Ryan Fritcher, and Don Zur. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Joe Vance. Our engineer is Danielle Parks.